Tiffany McConathy's daughter, Nora, was born on December 11th of 2020, and everything was going fine for her health-wise until September of 2021. That is when Tiffany and her husband, Jeremy, noticed a weakness on the side of her face, which Nora's pediatrician diagnosed as Bell's palsy. 6 weeks later, on Halloween, as Nora turned more lethargic and was not eating, Tiffany took Nora back to the hospital when it was decided to put tubes in Nora's ears. Tiffany insisted on Nora having an MRI and finally found a pediatric neurologist who was willing to give her one. The result was a diagnosis of an embryonal tumor with multilayered rosettes, or ETMR, which is a rare brain tumor with a dismal prognosis. Nora began treatment for this tumor, but it was cut short because Nora was diagnosed with COVID, in which her basic symptom was sneezing. The hospital decided that she could not continue her treatment because she had COVID, and she passed away on February 19th of this year. Not only did COVID preclude the treatment that certainly could have helped Nora at least live longer, COVID also prevented Tiffany from receiving a research autopsy in which Tiffany hoped to be able to donate Nora's tissue to help other patients. Tiffany will talk about these matters, plus the Princess Nora's Warrior Foundation, which she and Jeremy started to honor the memory of Nora. This foundation is just in its infancy. It is now my pleasure to welcome Tiffany McConathy to my podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, your daughter, Nora, was born on December 11th of 2020. Everything was going great and smoothly for the first 9 months of her life until you noticed a weakness on the side of her face, and you and your husband, Jeremy, responded by taking her to Arkansas Children's Hospital. What did the neurologist conclude that Nora had?
So with our first ER visit on September 16th of 2021, we saw the ER attending, and we also saw an ER resident at our local children's hospital, and they both said, well, this looks like Bell's palsy, but let's get a neurologist to come evaluate her. So they had a pediatric neurologist come evaluate her. And from a physical exam alone, she was diagnosed with Bell's palsy.
Okay, so she has Bell's palsy, supposedly. And so you go home, and now we go to the end of October, roughly 6 weeks later. Nora was lethargic. She wasn't eating well or walking, certainly not acting like herself. So you brought Nora back to the hospital on Halloween of last year. And what were you told then?
So they could certainly tell that she was more lethargic and she wouldn't eat. So after a little pressure, they admitted her to the hospital for dehydration. They assumed that because of her frequent ear infections, that she had developed a infection in the bone in the side of her skull. So they did a CT scan and really didn't see anything. So they had planned to do tubes in her ears, and after that they were going to send us home. But I requested with the pediatric team, I told them that she needed an MRI, and they disagreed. And then the ENT team, I asked them to do an MRI, they also disagreed, and I finally requested to see a different pediatric neurologist, and finally got them to agree to do an MRI of her brain while she was sedated for her tubes.
As is the case too many times, the parent or parents are the ones, first of all, they know their children better than any doctor, and they're the ones that get the ball rolling if they are dissatisfied that not enough is being done to find the problem that their child is having. You're a prime example of this. And how long did it actually take for the, I think, third or fourth person to finally agree to the MRI?
3 days.
3 days. Okay.
Well, yeah, so the 31st to November 2nd when they finally did it, they agreed the evening before that to do it the next day.
Okay, so early November, finally Nora has the MRI. What was found?
She had 3 brain tumors and multiple tumors throughout her spinal cord.
So now all of a sudden, not so sudden, because on September 16th, it was Bell's palsy. October 31st, it was an ear infection. And then you get the MRI finally, and she has 3 brain tumors and tumors up and down her spinal cord.
Yes.
Now your career took you from nursing school to your profession, which is being an oncology certified nurse practitioner.
Yes.
Now, I was watching a video of you, and you said that you had never experienced any type of personal relationship with someone who had cancer. And even though your job had you working with adults, because of what you were doing career-wise, did the MRI surprise you? And before the MRI was actually given, did the thought of some sort of cancer diagnosis for Nora cross your mind?
Yes. actually, whenever we noticed her facial paralysis in September, I told my husband when I left the house to take her to the hospital that she probably had a brain tumor.
Okay, so I guess the what came about was not a surprise. And this brain tumor, it's a pediatric cancerous brain tumor residing in the brain and in the nervous system, and it's called an embryonal tumor with multi-layered rosettes, or I guess it's more commonly known as ETMR. I was reading about that, and it had and has a dismal, and I'll quote that, prognosis. Were you told by Nora's oncologist and perhaps other doctors about this particular form of cancer and what it meant?
Yes. So whenever she was initially diagnosed, I just straight asked her doctor if we needed to do anything. I knew that her prognosis was going to be extremely poor being diagnosed in a metastatic setting. So I asked her doctor if we should do anything at all. He said yes, that the treatments can be very effective in some cases. And so he thought it was worth it to try. And my husband and I agreed.
Okay.
To give it a try.
So can you start with the treatment protocol that Nora received initially? And then I will ask you a question about what happened during that treatment, which wasn't completed. She had a case of COVID in which her only symptoms seemed to be sneezing, and that prevented her full treatment regimen to be completed. How long did the treatment last before she was diagnosed with COVID?
So she got her first 3 rounds of chemotherapy, which were approximately 3 weeks apart. She received 5 different drugs during that time. We had a 7-day hospital stay each time she was admitted. So she was admitted for her first cycle on November 15th. We started her chemotherapy, and she was roughly there for 7 days after. They give her 2 drugs on the first day, and then they wait 3 days, and they give her 3 drugs 3 days in a row after that. Very harsh old chemotherapy drugs that are 40 to 70 years old. They have extremely harsh side effects and they don't have anything else. They have nothing else for kids. And it's really a shame that this is what our kids are treated with. After her three rounds of chemotherapy, we were doing her. So she was supposed to get three autologous tandem stem cell transplants. So what that means is they give her high dose chemotherapy and then they give her her own stem cells back after that to help her body recover. Essentially, with a stem cell transplant, they take you to the brink of death and then bring you back. I've actually seen three children die from these curative treatments and other cancers from the transplant process, from side effects that they've had, heart failure, liver failure. But in the middle of that, you have to wait 3 to 4 weeks after their last treatment to start the process. So we did the stem cell collection. And as we were supposed to start the transplant, they swabbed them for like 15 different respiratory viruses each time when they're admitted to the hospital. When they admitted her to the hospital to start our transplant process, she tested positive for COVID. And because of that, her team did not feel it was safe to proceed with her treatment, even though she didn't have any symptoms. So they delayed her treatments again, which ultimately caused her death.
So I really have a very difficult time, frankly, understanding why they would do this when Nora was so sick. And the only way to even possibly save her was by doing the stem cell transplant. And February 19th comes just after, to 5 months after you initially brought her to the hospital, and Nora passed away because the cancer was too aggressive to handle. And they weren't doing what they needed to do about it. Now, on this COVID thing, what was the explanation that they gave to you that they say, well, we can't do this because of COVID? What was the risk that they were taking? Was it the risk to themselves or was it the risk to Nora?
So they felt like lowering her immune system. Essentially, they wipe out your entire immune system with the chemotherapy. And so they were afraid if there were viral cells left that they could essentially take over and she could have serious COVID illness from that if they did that.
Did Nora's team give you any other explanation, or was this at all satisfying to you and Jeremy when they told you what they were going to do?
I actually fought them about it. I tried to get them to go ahead, told them, we accept the risk, but we don't have time to mess around and wait, because the last time that she had to wait, which was 6 weeks from when she developed symptoms to when she was diagnosed, she went from probably one brain tumor to three plus however many were down her spine. There was too many for them to count. So in my opinion, it was a risk I was willing to take to start the process, even despite the COVID diagnosis.
What was her last few weeks? Was she in the hospital because you were getting ready for the stem cell procedure? And how long between the time that they said, no, we cannot do this procedure because of COVID until February 19th? How long a time period was that, if you remember?
So from her last treatment, so we were home probably for a week, maybe two in between her last chemotherapy and when she died. So we spent probably 3 weeks in the hospital.
And what was that 3 weeks like for her? I mean, was there any moment that she could have any type of relief during the situation?
There was her last week, she was extremely irritable and fussy and cried a lot and wanted to be held. And it seemed like she was in pain, but we couldn't figure out what was hurting her because she was so young. She couldn't tell us. So, you know, it was try pain medicines, try nausea medicines, try, you know, this technique or that to see if that she could get comfortable. But that last week, we never got to a comfort level of any kind.
Now, the second frustration, obviously very much understandable, is you expressed that you wanted to do a research autopsy because you wanted to donate her tissue, and I'm guessing that was for research purposes. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
Okay. The hospital refused to grant you this research autopsy because of COVID protocols, even though the CDC had protocols for research autopsies in place. Can you talk about that and what your oncologist found after he or she called 10 other hospitals to see if they could do the autopsy?
Yeah, so the night that she passed away, my husband and I had told the hospital that we wanted them to do a research autopsy. It was a teaching hospital, so it was well within their practices to do an autopsy. They didn't get a lot of tumor tissue from her initial biopsy, so I knew how important that was for testing purposes, as molecular sequencing is driving cancer therapy now. We have targeted therapies, so many targeted therapies in the adult cancer world, and there's just really nothing for kids. And I think it's because we don't have enough research in molecular sequencing and they're not being tested. So there can't be any new drugs developed for certain mutations because they don't know they exist. So I was wanting, and so her initial biopsy, there was not enough tissue to do this testing with. So I was really hopeful that they could get more tissue and be able to test, do molecular sequencing or hang on to tissue and do it as other tests come available. But as she had tested positive for COVID, she was at day 9 of her quote unquote symptoms, which was sneezing. At that point when she died, and they said because it had been within 14 days that they would not do it at the children's hospital we were at. And then our oncologist knew how important it was to get this because it's a rare diagnosis, and he knew the importance of needing that tissue and that testing to be done. So he attempted to call 10 other hospitals who all also denied to do a research autopsy due to her COVID status.
Okay. Even though the CDC itself had a satisfactory policy for what you wanted to do, the hospitals, all 10 or 11 or whatever it was, the most important one being Arkansas Children's, refused to change its policy.
Yes.
How high up, if you had the time and the inclination to do so, how high up did you go in the chain at Arkansas Children's to try to, you know, express what is an obvious case to these people in the hope that they would listen to reason?
We, unfortunately, time wasn't on our side at that point. You know, funeral arrangements and all these other things that, you know, tissue degrading and whatnot. So I didn't at the time have And then, you know, the recent grief, I just accepted at that point what was, and that our doctor tried his best to get that done for us. I was told later on that we probably could have asked the state crime lab to do an autopsy for us. And we could have paid out of pocket for that, which I would have gladly have done to help these other children. But at that point in time, she had already been cremated. At the time I found this out, and I eventually got the nerve to post on our social media page about what happened and the protocols, not to call anybody out, but just for awareness and to call for a call to action to have these policies changed. And I got the attention of one of our local news stations who covered our story and did a small segment on that. I don't know that it ever changed anything. But I gave it the best effort that I had.
Well, there's no doubt about that. There's no doubt that you are certainly in the right. And my question would be on this. Outside of the oncologist, who certainly recognized how important this research autopsy was, did anyone from the hospital side show any interest in the fact that you wanted to donate Nora's tissue to help other pediatric patients who were suffering as Nora did?
No, I heard nothing else about it after that.
Now, of course, it's been it's been a little while. It's now 7 or 8 months since Nora's passing. Do you have any idea if the policy has now changed?
I don't. The hospital is very tight-lipped about their policy and procedures, and it takes a lot to get information from them. And I am trying to work with them with our foundation, so I have tried not to push too many buttons with that avenue just to keep the peace, so to speak, because, you know, there's nothing I can do about it now, but I hope that they have seen the error of their ways at this point in time. A lot of parents probably don't make the decision to do that. It's a hard decision to make, but being in the medical field, I knew how important it was. So it was an easy decision for me, but I don't think many parents would probably make the same choice. So I'm not sure how often they're really faced with a decision like that.
Done a number of podcasts on pediatric brain cancer. And one of the things that I hear all the time from not just parents, but oncologists, doctors, et cetera, is it's really important for the future of these kids to get these tissue donations. Because that's the way, or one of the ways, that they can tell how a brain works, you know, with what either Nora or someone else had, and how hopefully in the future it'll be treated. I'm just going to ask one more question about this. When you posted on social media about what the situation was, what type of a reaction to you did you get?
An overwhelming response of people supporting us and being behind us and thinking the same thing we did, that it was a waste of an opportunity to advance pediatric cancer, to advance their knowledge about the disease state and probably what ultimately caused her death. She did have an MRI right before she died that showed widespread leptomeningeal disease. So her cancer was not a solid brain mass anymore. It was tiny deposits all in the lining of her brain. So, you know, why the rest of her disease was controlled and her brain tumors were shrinking and nearly gone, as well as her spinal tumors, but they had that meningeal spread, I think that they could have gained a lot of meaningful information from tissue sampling.
Obviously, no doubt about that. Now, in March of 2022, just a month after Nora's passing, you and Jeremy started the Princess Nora's Warriors Foundation in honor of Nora. Can you talk about your foundation and what you're trying to achieve with it?
So, like you said, we started that in March of 22. I have zero business experience. I have never worked with a nonprofit, so I had zero idea what I was doing, but I told my husband that I had a very unique mindset and opportunity to help these kids, because most people don't have the insight to being in oncology like I do. They don't really see what goes on behind the scenes and what's needed. So I said that we have to do something. So we created our foundation to give support for parents. So we do financial assistance for families of children with cancer. We also are supporting research, and recently have talked about joining the Coalition Against Childhood Cancer to support our advocacy aspect of our foundation, to raise awareness and to be with other like-minded foundations to support families and support anyone who is willing to help this navigate the pediatric cancer landscape. So far, since April, when we officially launched the foundation, we have raised over $100,000. We have supported several families, and we have also funded a preclinical trial for the type of cancer that my daughter had. It's CAR T. It's a CAR T therapy, and it uses the GPC2 target, and which is something that a lot of ETMR tumors. Now, I say a lot in a very loose sense, because there's only around 100 ETMR tumors that have been molecularly profiled, but the majority of those that were profiled did show this gene alteration. So I'm very excited about the potential for this trial. We are also, and we partnered with Solving Kids Cancer to fund that clinical trial. And we are in discussions with them again to partner with them to fund the first ever ETMR frontline therapy clinical trial with Dr. Derek Hansen at Hackensack in New Jersey. He is about to launch his clinical trial in January. So this will be a trial that develops a treatment protocol for kids with ETMR, because there isn't one right now.
Well, just a couple of things I'd like to comment on. First of all, if you're partnering up with the Coalition Against Childhood Cancer, or CAC2, as it's known as, they're a tremendous nonprofit. I'm actually a member of that nonprofit in a very minor way, but I am a member. And the people who run it, the people who are members of it, are great, great people. And they've got a wonderful collaborative mindset. So that's really going to help you, I think. And the CAR T cell is, it's worked very, very well for leukemia and the blood cancers over in pediatric cancers over the years. It's you know, documented, have had a quite a successful record, I guess is a good way to say it. No, it's a little bit not as well known for the bone cancers, the brain cancers, but they are trying everything they can to make it work. So it sounds like your foundation is certainly in the right place, and is going to be in the right places as you join CAC2. Now, I was again in the video that I saw, you said about 40% of what you're doing is focusing on research. 30% of it is involving financial matters with families. Can you talk about a couple of those financial matters that you're helping families with?
So we left that open to our discretion. We have an application that each family needs to fill out to get assistance, but they can submit a car payment, or they could submit their house note, or they could submit help with transportation to and from the hospital if we needed to buy them gas cards or if they needed us to help them with lodging. You know, there's a lot of different potentials, and we did not put a limit on how much we can help each person, which we may have to at some point in time. Right now, our funding's been really great, and I hope to continue the momentum that we've had so far. We basically, they can request anything. We have sent out letters recently if they needed help with Christmas, that we would be happy to help them, you know, get Christmas gifts for their children. So it's not a one size fits all for each family. Each family's needs will be different depending on, we spend a lot of time in the hospital. So it was really nice for us to have help. We had a foundation that offered to have our house cleaned for us. So if that's something that would help the family, we could certainly consider that. So our main goal is to make sure that obviously their bills are taken care of and that their children are able to be cared for without the families having financial worry about if they're going to have their lights on or if they're going to have transportation to be able to take their child to and from the doctors. So those are our main concerns. But if we do have extra, we will definitely try to help with other things that they need.
Well, you know, when a child gets diagnosed with cancer, the first thing and obviously the most important thing is we have to get our child in the hospital, get treatment going. And the financial, paying for gas is not something that they think of right away. So these foundations and these nonprofits that recognize that certainly are very, very important. Now, you've raised over $100,000 so far. How have you been able to raise that much money? Is it donations, events? What are some of the things that you've done to raise this type of money?
So far, we've had three events this year. That's been the bulk of our money that we've raised. We do have very generous donors. We've got a lot of support from family in our community. We had a 5K on September 24th. That was during Pediatric Cancer Awareness Month. We had a little over 100 people that ran, which was crazy to me for a first time race. And we had Miss Arkansas came and handed out the awards. It was just a really, really great time. We raised $34,000 with our 5K. From sponsorships and participants. And then we are having this Saturday, which is going to be October 22nd, we are having our first nursing fair. And so we have drug companies who have sponsored educational booths to talk to the nurses and the nurse practitioners who will be attending the conference. And myself and several of my colleagues will be doing presentations about different things in oncology. And we're really excited about this. And that's raised a little over $50,000. So that's been a big portion of the money that we've raised has been from events. So just looking for all the events and money that we can find. We've also gotten several grants. We've applied for grants through Walmart and some of the bigger box stores who have given us grants. So we've gotten some funding from that as well.
The $50,000 that you've raised for tomorrow's nursing fair, now, is the potential, in other words, if someone's listening, of course, it's a stupid question because we're recording the podcast, the nursing fair will be over. But if someone was driving down the street and saw a sign for it, could they just go tomorrow and add to the total number of dollars that you've already?
Absolutely. We're taking registrants up until the day of, but the event's actually free to the participants. So anybody that's watching or listening, the way we made money was by basically having a vendor fee. So anybody that has a table at the event is who had to pay.
Now, the foundation, of course, is really in its infancy as you're just really starting this. You've done very well so far. And I know you say you've had no business experience, but you also had no experience with anyone who had pediatric cancer. And when it came up on you, you knew exactly what to do. So down the road, you'll, I'm sure, have a lot more business experience. Have you thought perhaps 5 or 10 years down the road where you want the foundation to be, or is it too soon for that?
No, I fully intend on having a national foundation. I want to be like Alex's lemonade stand. I want everybody and everyone to know about our foundation and what we're doing. I would love in the next 5 to 10 years to be working full time for the foundation. So, you know, right now I would love to just quit my job and do this full time, but unfortunately I can't. But one day I'm hopeful that I can. Nobody in our foundation is paid right now. So that's something that we want to keep very low on our priority list, is having paid employees. So right now, everybody that volunteers or that works for our foundation is on a volunteer basis. So I suspect it will be probably many years before we can have paid employees. We would want to keep that a very low budget for that. So that would mean we were having to make significant money to be able to afford salaries.
I was looking at the list of your board members, and certainly your husband, Jeremy, plays a primary role. I believe he's maybe the chief technical officer. I don't know if I got that right. But is he equally as committed to you down the road of making this maybe the Alex's lemonade stand of Arkansas, or something to that effect? Because that's a huge and very important foundation.
Yes, he is very on board with that. He, you know, we're hoping through his IT career, he's retired from the Air Force and he has a second career in IT. We're hopeful that he can get some promotions and get some raises that will allow me to step back from my job as a nurse practitioner and work for the foundation.
That's, of course, great to hear as you advance in this thing. I'm sure the conversation at home will be a lot about this foundation as time goes on. I'd just like to ask you one question, final question, really, about a tumor board meeting, which was made up of neuro-oncology specialists from around the world, which discussed the ETMR tumor that Nora had. Did you learn anything about what they said that might have helped Nora, had anyone that had worked on her case knew about beforehand?
Yeah, so basically it was hit those cancers hard and fast and don't stop for anything, was the take-home message. To get the best outcomes, they have to have all three modalities of treatment, meaning they have to have chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. Those are the kids that have the best outcomes, which means that they also have to be diagnosed early. They have to be diagnosed when they have a solid one brain tumor to be able to resect it, and then they need high-dose chemotherapy followed by radiation. Nora was, of course, too young for radiation, so we were doing the transplant chemotherapy in place of that, which they have had some decent outcomes with, but overall, the good outcomes are from having multiple modalities of treatment, and sometimes recurrent. So many of the children that were still living have had multiple brain surgeries and radiation and several rounds of chemotherapy, and then been on some type of maintenance strategy.
Are you at all encouraged? Again, it's been, well less than a year since Nora passed away, but are you encouraged at all as you perhaps delve in more to ETMR that there are better days ahead for these kids if the diagnosis is done on time and if the proper protocol as far as treatments is done?
Yes, I'm very encouraged. Dr. Derek Hansen is the nation's leading doctor in this disease state. He has all his chips in the basket. He has had several successful treatments, and he runs right now the ETMR1 registry, which is a national registry for all of the kids with ETMR if they want to be registered and they take their treatment. And they put them all in a registry to see what's working and what's not.
Well, that certainly is good news to hear. Where can people get in touch with you, get in touch with the Princess Nora's Warriors Foundation if they'd like to learn more about it, perhaps help out, donate, and do some things that are going to help ETMR in the future?
Our website is noraswarriors.com, NORASWARRIORS.com. We're also on all the social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, LinkedIn. You can search Princess Nora's Warrior Foundation under any of those socials, and our page should come right up for you. We are a registered 501c3, and any donations that are made are tax deductible. So if you know any businesses or own a business and you need a charitable donation, we would love to have you support us. We love to honor our businesses on our website. We've got different partners and our annual sponsors. Once they've donated a certain amount, we promote their business at every event and also on our social media site. So that's one way that we try to give back to the community as well.
Well, as we come to the end of this podcast, I want to first of all thank you for, you know, taking the time to come on, explain what Nora went through. I think that what you've had to go through during this ordeal was very, aside obviously from the end result and the treatment. The COVID situation, the hospital situation was very unfortunate. And the hope, I guess, is that maybe they've learned something from this as far as possibly, you know, being more accepting of tissue donations, how important they are. And the hope, I guess, again, is that what happened will be a positive for them and everyone down the road. And I want to wish you and Jeremy the best of luck as time goes on.
Thank you so much. We so appreciate you having us today.
And you have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
I am sure that you could tell the obvious and well-deserved frustration that Tiffany expressed when talking about how COVID impacted Nora's treatment, both before and after her passing. You might have noticed my frustration as well, as it is hard to fathom why Nora was not given everything that she deserved and everything that Tiffany wanted for her. This is Mark Levine, and please tune in on Thursday when I will speak with Dr. Archie Blyer, who was the chair of the Children's Cancer Group for 10 years in the 1990s, and then became a critical voice and leader in the sometimes overlooked group of adolescent and young adults, better known as AYAs, who have many cancer battles of their own that they need to fight.